Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Well, it's extremely dry, and there's thunderstorms with lightning in the forecast.
Fire danger heading into the holiday weekend prompts emergency burn bans. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, among recent major Supreme Court decisions, a ruling on states' powers to prosecute on tribal land.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to always be educated to these issues, but I think the direct application in Alaska is pretty limited, actually non-existent.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Much of interior and south central Alaska is under an emergency burn closure starting at midnight. Alaska Division of Forestry and Fire Protection spokesman Sam Harrell says the weather forecast for that part of the state through the weekend could lead to wildfires.
Well, it's extremely dry, and there's thunderstorms with lightning in the forecast.
Areas covered by the burn ban include the Denali, Matsu, Kenai, and Fairbanks North Star boroughs, as well as the cities of Tok and Delta Junction and the Copper River Basin. The municipality of Anchorage already has burn restrictions in place, including prohibiting open fires. Harrell says the ban doesn't mean all fires are banned. He says using a charcoal grill or starting a fire at a campground contained in a steel ring is still allowed.
A circle of rocks is not acceptable. Backcountry campfires are not permitted.
Burning debris piles as well as uncontained cooking or signaling fires are also prohibited. The state also suspended firework use starting yesterday in the area of the state covered by the burn ban. The banning of firework use is in place indefinitely as the state heads into the 4th of July weekend. The state said it could not risk another human-caused fire starting. According to state emergency officials, there are already about 160 fires burning in Alaska, with 17 of them staffed with firefighters. Meanwhile, fires in the interior sent smoke into the northwest. Air quality monitors in Nome hit levels far above emergency conditions today. The National Weather Service issued a dense smoke advisory for Nome, White Mountain, and Golovin. Visibility was less than 1 mile, and drivers were advised to use their headlights. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency lacks authority to broadly regulate greenhouse gases as pollutants. The opinion was a victory for the coal companies in 19 Republican-led states that undertook the challenge, including Alaska, and curbs President Joe Biden's ability to pursue his climate goals. In the 6-3 decision, the court's conservatives ruled that Congress only empowered the EPA to narrowly regulate the emissions of individual power plants, and the EPA could not require a sweeping industry-wide shift from coal and gas power to renewable sources. The suit goes back to 2015 when West Virginia and others challenged the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, a rule that established emission guidelines for states to limit carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. The EPA under President Donald Trump rescinded the rule in 2019 and replaced it with the less stringent Affordable Clean Energy Rule. A federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. struck that rule down last year, saying the EPA was required to at least consider more aggressive alternatives. And going against decades of precedent in law on Native American sovereignty, the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday ruled in an Oklahoma case that states can prosecute non-Native people for crimes against Native people that occur on tribal land. Alaska, like some 20 other states, already has federal approval from Congress granting such authority, so the decision itself won't have much effect in Alaska, says Lloyd Miller, an Anchorage-based lawyer and Indian law specialist with Sanosky Chambers. But Miller says the decision still marks a major change that turns long-held principles of Indian law upside down.
So I think it's a real watershed decision in this area of Indian law, and I think there could be grave implications for Indian law in the years to come. If this remains the court's new way of looking at federal Indian law and principles of tribal sovereignty, which are intimately woven with exemption from state sovereignty. Of course, the entire case arises in Indian country, specifically on Indian reservations. To that extent, the case is somewhat less germane to the situation in Alaska where Indian country is limited.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit more about that here in a second, but what does this case actually do? I mean, for tribes in the United States and for states and these decisions about prosecuting crimes, what does it actually do?
The case holds that the state of Oklahoma has the authority to prosecute crimes committed by non-Indian people against Indian people on an Indian reservation. Up until this decision, it was generally understood, and the law was, that states did not have that authority, that only the federal government had the power to prosecute those crimes. Unless Congress passed a statute that granted states that kind of power, and Congress has provided statutes that impact over 20 states. One of those statutes is known as Public Law 280 and was applied to the territory of Alaska before Alaska became a state. But that has always operated based on the backdrop that if Congress didn't confer that authority on the state, state didn't have the authority. Now the Supreme Court is saying, you know what? States had that authority all along, which is really a stunning shift in Indian law principles.
Does this decision from Wednesday, does that have much impact on Alaska? Are there implications here that people should know about?
I think it's important for people to always be educated to these issues, but I think the direct application in Alaska is pretty limited, actually non-existent, for two reasons. First of all, there's precious little Indian country in Alaska, and the case only involves the legal rules that apply in Indian country. But secondly, more to the point, Alaska is one of those over 20 states as to which Congress passed a statute, Public Law 280, conferring full criminal jurisdiction on the state of Alaska to prosecute all crimes that come up in any Indian country that might exist. So the case isn't particularly significant in terms of its actual facts and the results and the rule. The state already has complete jurisdiction.
So this case decided Wednesday, it deals with a state's ability to prosecute a non-Native person for a crime committed in Indian country. But there have been some developments here more recently with tribal powers to prosecute crimes. Is that right? Am I understanding that correctly?
That's right. In this field, there's a whole body of law that addresses crimes committed by non-Indians and prosecuted by states. There's a whole other body of law that addresses prosecutions by tribes. Also now a new body of law, the ink has just dried, on the Violence Against Women Act amendments of 2022, which addresses tribal authority to prosecute non-Indian offenders in Alaska Native villages. As your listeners know, Alaska Native villages are not Indian reservations and they're not Indian country, but as a practical matter, crime occurs in the villages. And sometimes those crimes occur by non-Indians and non-Natives, of course, as well as by Native offenders. The Violence Against Women Act establishes a framework for dealing with that. First, it affirms that Alaska tribes do possess authority to criminally prosecute all Alaska Native offenders that are in an Alaska Native village. And then it sets up, secondly, a process by which Alaska tribes can prosecute non-Native people who commit certain crimes, domestic violence, child violence, certain crimes against law enforcement in Alaska Native villages, even without Indian country. So these developments that occurred this year in amendments to the Violence Against Women Act operate entirely outside this Supreme Court decision that dealt with the rules involving Indian country, which is reservations, allotments, and dependent Indian communities. This new development operates entirely outside of that. It's a new rubric, if you will, that addresses uniquely Alaska Native villages. And in fact, this new enactment says no one should get any idea that Alaska Native villages are being deemed Indian country, equivalent to reservations down south. They are not. The legislation says so.
That was Lloyd Miller, a lawyer with Sonoski Chambers specializing in Indian law. And full disclosure, two of his law partners wrote an amicus brief cited in the dissenting opinion in Wednesday's Supreme Court decision. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a traditional Filipino folk dance makes a comeback in Juneau.
When we started doing school performances during like basketball games, that was intimidating. I was like, oh my gosh, people are going to know what I'm doing.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Government entities at all levels, federal, state, and municipal, purchase a broad range of products and services from private businesses, and adding government customers can provide a good, steady stream of ongoing work. Alaska PTAC can help your business navigate the many regulations, laws, and procedures involved with government contracting. Go to ptacalaska.org to schedule your appointment with a contract specialist. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
Sitka-based Silver Bay Seafoods in June agreed to pay a fine of nearly $470,000 for illegal dumping at its Snacknik River facility in Bristol Bay. The company has also agreed to address violations of its state permit to discharge pollutants. KDLG's Izzy Ross reports.
The State Department of Environmental Conservation said in a press release that Silver Bay, quote, repeatedly discharged significantly more fish waste into the Naknek River than permitted in 2017 and 2020. State inspectors also found numerous violations at the facility during a scheduled inspection last year. Processors are allowed to discharge up to 10 million pounds of fish waste into surrounding waters. Randy Bates, the director of water at the Department of Environmental Conservation, says Silver Bay did ask permission to discharge more. The department denied them.
We said, no, you cannot go over that 10 million pounds. They voluntarily went over that each of those years, knowing that there was a hard limit at 10 million pounds.
Bates says that in 2017, Silver Bay went over by 2.9 million pounds. In 2020, they exceeded the limit by 5.1 million pounds and reported the violations to the state after the fact. Silver Bay Seafood's Naknek facility processes about 2 million pounds of fish a day. Bates says that's much more than other processors in the area.
The other facilities there probably don't discharge nearly as much as Silver Bay Seafoods do. So while I believe that all of those facilities operating up there that operate under the general permit, they all have that 10 million pound limit. I don't think that there's anybody else coming close to that 10 million pound discharge limit.
This is not the first time Silver Bay Seafoods has paid fines for illegal discharge. In 2019, the company settled a lawsuit with the Environmental Protection Agency for excess dumping. Silver Bay Seafoods did not respond to a request for an interview. In an email, Director of Communications Abby Frederick said, quote, Silver Bay Seafoods voluntarily implemented corrective actions before the settlement was finalized. We are confident those measures will ensure compliance for this season and beyond, unquote. The DEC's Bates says in both 2017 and 2020, the state gave Silver Bay other options for disposing of fish waste.
You could bury it, you could transport it to another facility to grind and discharge, you could take it on a gurry vessel out to deeper waters where we would allow them or permit them to discharge it.
Bates says DEC talked with the company over the winter about how to avoid going over the 10 million pound limit this season. He says options include the company contracting with one or more tenders to take waste further offshore to dispose of it, freezing waste in blocks and turning it into pet food, and transferring fish to other facilities. Bates says that Silver Bay's nearly $500,000 fine for the excess discharge in the Naknek River will go to the state's general fund. In Dillingham, I'm Izzy Ross.
In Interior Alaska, Golden Valley Electric Association's Board of Directors voted Monday to upgrade the aging Healy Unit 1 power plant with a new emissions control system and keep it operating. But in a surprise decision, the board also decided to shut down the newer Healy 2 power plant because they said it was unreliable and becoming increasingly costly. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
For months now, Golden Valley officials have talked about the difficult decision on whether to install a new emissions control device on the 55-year-old Healy 1 power plant or shut it down by the end of 2024. Until Monday night, when an expert hired by the utility said his analysis suggested a third alternative: upgrade Healy 1 and shut down Healy 2, the newer coal-fired power plant that's been problem-plagued since it began commercial operations 4 years ago.
It is more economic to retire Healy 2.
Mike Hubbard is a utility consultant with Anchorage-based financial engineering company, and he's been working for Golden Valley over the past year since it began studying its power-generating facilities. He said in the presentation Monday that he was hired to advise on the Healy 1 decision and replacement of the co-op's battery energy storage system, or BESS. But he said it soon became apparent that advances in renewable energy technology, especially wind power, could solve both problems and provide another source to replace the 50-megawatt Healy 2.
Go out and get some wind, and you'll have to do a BESS.
Hubbard says newer and more powerful battery technology could regulate the intermittent wind power by providing electricity when the air is calm. He said that, and buying more power from South Central utilities that could be transmitted up the interties, could enable Golden Valley to reduce the ongoing cost of fixing Healy 2 problems that have kept the plant operating at about half capacity. It was offline again on Monday.
We're looking at replacing coal with gas-fired generation from Anchorage.
Most of the 18 members of the public who logged into the online meeting expressed surprise and support for the recommendation. And so did mining company executives from Northern Star Resources, the Australia-based owner of the Pogo Gold Mine, and Kinross Fort Knox Gold, the Canadian-owned operation that's Golden Valley's biggest commercial customer.
For us, the current electricity situation at Fort Knox is not sustainable.
Sunil Kumar is Kinross Fort Knox's vice president for energy strategy and engineering. He told the board that the company pays substantially more for power here than in many of its other operations worldwide. And he said Golden Valley generates much more emissions than utilities for its other operations. He urged the board to adopt an ambitious plan like the one proposed by Hubbard to hold down costs and reduce greenhouse gases, or GHGs.
A mining industry needs reliable electricity at reasonable prices, but also with low GHG emissions.
After more public testimony and board discussion, it came time for a vote on the plan based on the consultant's recommendations called the Strategic Generation Plan. All seven members of the board spoke in near unanimous favor of the five-point plan, but board chair Tom DeLong disagreed with one part of it that called for spending $26.1 million on the SCR emissions control system for Healy 1. DeLong said that plant, too, should be shut down.
While the installation of the SCR will allow it to run in the future, it is unlikely that it will be uneconomical compared to wind, solar, and storage, which are proving to be the least expensive electric generating units in the world.
Board member Gary Newman proposed an amendment to delete the Healy 1 emissions upgrade, but the other board members defeated the amendment 5-2, with DeLong joining Newman in support. In the end, the board voted 6-1 to move ahead on the plan, with DeLong the lone dissenter. The vote called for Golden Valley to map out a process within 90 days on how it would retire Healy 2 that included help for workers who might be displaced by the shutdown. The board then voted separately to proceed with the installation of the emissions control system for Healy 1. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, celebrating 100 years of helping Alaskans shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Are you ready to start accelerating your child's future through education? The Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program is expanding its reach with new opportunities in Juneau and Southeast Alaska. With ANSEP's Acceleration Academy, high school students can earn college credit, save thousands of dollars in college costs, and experience fun, hands-on learning. ANSEP, it's a better way to learn. Learn more and enroll at ansep.net/acceleration. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Voters will now decide whether Sitka adopts a new cannabis tax, because on Tuesday, the Sitka Assembly voted to put it on the municipal election ballot this fall. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports.
The new ballot proposition would eliminate the standard city sales tax on cannabis and replace it with one that would gradually increase to 8%. The proceeds would benefit the Sitka School District's Student Activities Fund, which pays for travel, supplies, and other expenses. Assemblymember Tor Christensen said he supported putting it on the ballot, but he didn't know if he'd vote in favor or against at the polls.
It's essentially eventually going to be about 2.5% hike in taxes, because the most of this is taken, it's going to be a transfer from the money that we were already taking for normal sales tax. And honestly, if I'm going to vote against it as a citizen, that would be why, just because the whole it's going to put in the general fund. But I have no problem putting it on the ballot to let the people of Sitka decide.
It's not the first time the Assembly has considered putting a marijuana tax out to the voters. In 2021, a ballot prop that would have levied an additional 5% tax on cannabis failed on a split vote. Assemblymember Kevin Mosher was a no vote last year. This time, he voted in favor.
We talked about it quite a bit. The very first go around, and then we made some adjustments, some compromises, and I feel like this is fair, and putting on forth to the voters, let everyone decide.
So what exactly are those compromises? The ballot prop the Assembly settled on is different from the ordinance brought forth by sponsors Rebecca Hemshute and Kevin Knox in May. Initially, they'd proposed a tax that would have gradually increased to 10%, but that was reduced to 8%. And they also added language to confirm that the revenue collected from the tax would be separate from the city's annual contribution to the Sitka School District. Assemblymember Kevin Knox, concerned that there's still some confusion about the ballot prop out there, wanted to reiterate that the tax is not in addition to sales tax, it replaces it, and it's levied on consumers, not businesses.
It's not technically income that the business is losing or gains and then loses. It's a consumer tax, just like our sales tax. Totally in favor of seeing this on the October ballot myself. If it passes tonight, looking forward to continuing the dialogue with the community and seeing how it fares.
No one from the public commented on the final vote, but at previous meetings, the ballot prop has been supported by a handful of educators and parents who say the tax is necessary in order to help fund student activities, which have become increasingly more expensive, especially with less accessible ferry service for student travel. The measure was also challenged at previous meetings by a few cannabis business owners who are concerned that the new tax will make legal cannabis less competitive against Sitka's existing illegal market. At the first reading in early June, the ordinance passed 5-2 with Member Crystal Duncan and Mayor Steven Eisenbeiss opposed. It passed 5-0 in their absence on final reading. It will appear on the ballot in the October 4th municipal election. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
Filipino dance groups used to be a big deal in Juneau. There were multiple troupes who practiced regularly and performed at the Filipino Community Hall. They even danced at high school basketball games. Now it's making a comeback. KTOO's Jennifer Pemberton has the story.
David Abad shows up at the Zach Gordon Youth Center carrying two long bamboo poles. He bought them on Etsy.
It was really hard to find. And then I just went on Etsy and it was just like, we'll ship you 8-foot-long poles. And I was like, perfect.
It's been 15 years at least since Taninkling was big in Juneau. Abad was really into the dance growing up in Juneau's Filipino community, and he wants to bring it back. Taninkling is a traditional folk dance from the Visayas region of the Philippines. It's now the country's national dance. Two people get on either end of two long bamboo poles and clap them together. Dancers jump in and out of the poles in between claps, trying to avoid getting their ankles whacked. They're supposed to look like a tinkling bird, trying to avoid a foot snare set by rice farmers. That's what the dance is named after. The clinic starts with a video that offers some inspiration. It's a group of college students performing the dance to a Lil Nas X song, not the traditional Spanish rondola. They are awesome, jumping in and out of the poles super fast. It's just cool. And the crowd in the video goes wild. And the dozen or so kids watching are pumped now, too. Abad asks for volunteers to be the clappers, the people who tap the poles twice on the ground and then snap them together in the middle.
I used to do the dance and didn't really think about the clappers' role, but just thinking about, like, they're so important because they get to control the speed. Obviously, it's easier with music.
It doesn't take long to start feeling the rhythm in your whole body. Julia Velasco is 9 years old. She says she's a little bit Filipino, but she's never seen this before or tried it.
It's like a really nice way of dancing. Oh, the little girl's dancing too. Yeah, she's so cute.
The little girl is 5-year-old Daryl. She's here with her mom, Jennifer Lagandino.
Her dad is Filipino, and she's been asking to learn Filipino dance for a while, so we saw this. A friend sent us this
And this is your first
event,
time trying so this?
First time.
Yeah.
You did really good.
First, Daryl sits in front of her mom and wraps her little fingers around the sticks while they clap them together. But it's not too long until she wants to be center stage as the dancer. People dance for hours. They take turns working the sticks and dancing in the middle. They're sweaty and out of breath. It's a workout. David Abad is stoked.
I'd love to have more, you know, folks interested and, you know, maybe do it as a more... like a hobby, pick it up, do, you know, even go as far as doing some choreography could be fun.
When he was young in the early 2000s, there were at least 50 Filipino kids who danced regularly. When they danced at the Filipino Community Hall, he says they were proud, but he was less comfortable dancing in front of the wider population.
It was almost something done in secret, but I'm sure other kids, you know, felt proud. But yeah, like, especially when we started doing school performances during, like, basketball games, that was intimidating. I was like, oh my gosh, people are going to know what I'm doing. So I didn't participate in too many of those.
He stopped dancing in high school. So the small crowd today is inspiring. There isn't just interest. There's enthusiasm from Filipino kids and kids who are a little Filipino, and even one who said that Tininkling made them wish that they were Filipino. In Juneau, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early and Liz Ruskin in Anchorage, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, Catherine Rose in Sitka, and Jennifer Pemberton in Juneau. Well, there's the sticks. Our audio engineers, Tobin Shelby, I'm Casey Grove. Be safe and have a great 4th of July weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline since 1977, from Prudhoe Bay to the Port of Valdez.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.